Before we start this episode, I want to take a quick moment to share another podcast with you. It's one I've been listening to myself. It's called Gone at 21. J. Ryan Green, professional private investigator, puts you in the passenger seat as he investigates the death of Caitlin Markham. I'm going to let him tell you about it in his own words, and then we'll get on with episode 5.
Hey folks, this is J. Ryan. I'm the host of Gone at 21. This podcast chronicles my investigation into the Caitlin Markham disappearance and death. Caitlin was a talented 21-year-old college student who vanished from her Fairfield, Ohio townhouse in August of 2011. Her skeletal remains were found in Indiana 20 months later. This is a raw production. The interviews you hear in this podcast are a part of the case file. Interviews include her fiancé, who was the last documented person to see Caitlin alive. Join me on my investigation where I obtain evidence police didn't process and interview people from Caitlin's inner circle who were overlooked during the initial investigation. After listening to Unconcluded, come on over and get caught up on Gone at 21. Help me get justice for Caitlin.
...24-year-old Jennifer Kessie disappeared January 24th, 2006. She was last seen at her condo on Conroy Road.
We're going to solve a missing persons case which has haunted Orlando investigators.
So we're still waiting for that one person to come through with the one bit of information that could bring Jennifer home.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessie in Orlando, Florida. I'm Sean Gerd. Let's go back for a moment to the 10-year anniversary press conference that Jennifer's parents had with Orlando police. There's something that Drew Kessie said that I want to remind you of.
But the answers are there. They've always been there. We just haven't been able to see them clearly yet. And someday we will. But I want the public to know, and we've seen it constantly, probably over the last 7 to 10 years, that the public is solving the most heinous crimes. They're speaking up. They're doing the things that we ask, and that, you know, the families ask of the victims. And we ask you to continue with us down this journey. We know it's been long. We know that new things just don't come out all the time, if not ever.
This is important to remember. Because of that public, today, we have new questions to consider. What if some of the things we've all come to accept about this case, about the days and weeks leading up to Jennifer's abduction, aren't as close to the truth as we've believed? Just hours after episode 4 was released, while we were still trying to determine the possibility of Jennifer being in a Tennessee jewelry store, we got another tip. And this new lead forces us to consider if there's much more to this case in the time prior to Jennifer's actual disappearance. Just a mile from Mosaic at Millennia, the condo where Jennifer lived, and just on the other side of the mall at Millennia, is another apartment complex by the name of Northbridge at Millennia Lake. It's here that someone I'll refer to as Erica remembers a strange interaction with Jennifer just prior to her disappearance.
I had experienced something several years ago where Jennifer Kessie actually came into my workplace, and that's how I'm pretty much... her story has stuck with me for 11 years. Basically, my husband and I were from Atlanta, and we had moved to Orlando, and we had been there for about a year. My husband wanted to, continue his education, and I had gotten a job at an apartment community called Northbridge Apartments, actually Northbridge at Millennia Lakes. Northbridge was a new up-and-coming community, and it was really awesome. It was like one of those luxury communities, and they were kind of setting the trend with the retail stores at the bottom of the apartments were up at the top and the retail stores were at the bottom and stuff. And when I started working there, actually the community was probably at 20% occupied, should I say. And so we definitely had a lot of lease up to do. So we had a lot of people coming through there. I remember just it being extremely busy. It was really hard. There were some hard days working there because it was so busy, anywhere from, 50 on an average, just 50 people coming into your office during the weekday. But on the weekend, you'd experience like 100, 130 people coming in. So that was a lot of traffic. But anyway, after I had been there for about a year, just on this random January day, a girl comes walking into the office and I asked if I could help her. And so I kind of motioned her to come over to my desk, and she sat down. And she was a really beautiful girl. She was really striking. Her eyes especially was what caught me, because she had really beautiful eyes, blonde hair. She was young. And I asked her, what brought her to Northbridge? And she said, I'm looking for a one-bedroom apartment. And so I got out a guest card and I was, getting information. And I asked her her name, and she said, my name is Jennifer Kessie. And so I started writing down her name and all that stuff, just asking her questions, what she was looking for, what was her expected move-in date, and all that wonderful stuff. While I was asking her these questions, she was completely distracted by something. There were these huge windows that you could see outside to the entrance of the community and all that stuff, of the offices. And so as I was talking to her, she wasn't making eye contact with me. She actually was just looking out the window like if she was looking for someone. And her attention span was just somewhere else. And so I kept asking her questions, just about what her likes are and, does she have any pets and just things like that. And at this point, about 5 minutes into asking her questions, I'm not getting anything back from her. I'm just kind of getting these random, just kind of short answers, but nothing that is trying to help me help her to find a home, because that's what I thought she came in there to do. And so at this point, I started getting really just kind of like, man, this girl, what's up with this girl? She's not interested in an apartment. She's just wasting my time. So I asked her, do you want to look at a one bedroom? She said, no, I don't want to look at a one bedroom. But during this time, as I continued talking, it's almost like she let me continue to just keep asking her stuff. And she would give these short, answers. She wouldn't really give any detail about anything. And she kept looking outside. And I was under the impression that she was, I felt like she was in there wasting my time. Like she came in there and she just was just, biding her time about something. I don't know what, but at that point, 10 minutes had already passed by and there was nothing else for us to talk about because she didn't want to see a one bedroom. And so she asked me about something else, and I don't recall what it was, but it was, I guess, information, like an information packet, and she would take it with her. So at that moment, I just kept talking to her, and I just kept looking at her, and I'm thinking, okay, she's okay. I'm just going to give her whatever information she wants, and I'm just going to let her go because, she's just not really interested. Maybe she's just wanting to just see something or just came in here and get some information and then just go. But something about her just was off. And so anyway, She got up and she left. She apparently just took one thing with her, from what I can recall. And it was just one piece of paper. And she left. And I remember when I was sitting there and I was writing her name, I thought, oh, you know, her name sounds like, you know, it's Kessie. What, you know, that's a nice last name, kind of sounds like kisses or, you know, whatever. And that's why her name stuck out to me. That's why it was just like, it was memorable to me because of her last name. And so basically, you know, after about 10, 15 minutes of her being there, you know, she left. And that was it on that. And that was several days, before she actually disappeared. It had to have been, sometime the week before she was abducted, because that was the length of time. And the thing was, is that I wouldn't be surprised if she even came in, because it was so long ago, but I wouldn't be surprised if she even came in on a Saturday, the Saturday or the Sunday before. Because when I remember, I mean, we had a lot of people coming into the office, and our office was always packed, but it was extraordinarily packed on the day that she came in, because we had people all over the place in the lobby and standing at, we had at that time in our office, I want to say we had like 8 leasing consultants. That's how busy Northbridge was. And so I want to say it could have been even that Saturday or that Sunday before. And I mean, because there were so many people there, but she came in, I want to say it was during the day. She came in anywhere between 1:30 and like 3 o'clock. And yeah. So, and it was, I remember it was a beautiful sunny day. And yeah.
Based on Erica's recollection, that would place Jennifer in the Northbridge Apartments office sometime on or after Saturday, January 14th, 2006. And we know that Jennifer left for her St. Croix vacation on that Thursday. So if this was Jennifer, it would have had to have been between January 14th and January 18th, 2006. I asked Erica about when she finally realized that the person that had been in her office that day was now missing.
Wednesday morning, that following week, Wednesday morning, I was getting ready for work. And I was, you know, of course, we live in Florida, so I was checking the weather because I was thinking, what am I going to wear today? And, you know, what's the weather going to be like? So basically, I am looking at the news, and all of a sudden there's this picture of this girl that basically it just pops up on the screen and says, you know, missing. And there's this picture, and it all of a sudden, like, the screen flashes Jennifer Kessie, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, this girl looks really familiar. Like, I was just stunned. Just stunned for like a minute. I just stood there and I just looked at her. And I thought, surely not. Surely this can't be the same girl. And so I didn't know what to think. And so I hurried and I went downstairs and I went down to the office and I pulled the guest card. And sure enough, it said Jennifer Kessie, and it was her. And cause I remember her eyes. I remember her. She had real pretty blonde hair, you know, shoulder length hair. And she was very distinct. She was a very beautiful girl. So I she had a look that was, you would remember her by. So, whenever I saw that, I was just really in shock. Like, I didn't really honestly know what to think. So, I just sat there and I looked at the guest card and I'm thinking, oh my God, like, I can't believe it. I can't believe this girl is missing. She just came in and she talked to me and I just can't believe that this is her. And at that moment, I was thinking, what do I do? Do I take this guest card? You know, what do I do? And so I, you know, and I thought, no, I'll leave it, because my heart was just beating 100 miles an hour thinking, oh my God, this girl's actually missing. And so I remember when I got off of work, like, it's all I could think about. When I got off of work, I remember going up to my bedroom and was just so nervous. And I called the FBI crime line. And at this point, the news, everything in the news was about Jennifer Kesey, about her disappearance and her parents. I remember the news saying that her parents were at her house, were at her place, and they were in the area. They were like, they had already rallied up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to pass out flyers. I remember, because I mean, I lived, like, you know, literally on the other side of Millennium Mall, which her house was on the front side of Millennium Mall. My house was on the back side of Millennium Mall. And I just remember just calling the crime line and telling them, this girl came into my office, sat at my desk, and was asking for a one-bedroom apartment, and she was sketched out. She was scared, and I just thought she was completely wasting my time because I was trying to talk to her, but she was somewhere else completely, and her eyes were just constantly just looking like looking outside and trying to survey as if she were looking for someone, or like she was hiding. And while I was thinking all of these things and telling this to the crime line, like, all of these things started flooding back, how she was acting, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, just put on your detective hat and think, you know, could she have just gone in there because someone was following her? Maybe she was biding her time, something, you know, because she was obviously very frightened, and she, anyway.
As Erica shared the details of her story, I could hardly believe it. It wasn't just that she believed she'd seen Jennifer acting strangely in the week leading up to her disappearance. She'd confirmed it after checking the logbook in the guest office. My mind was racing, and I was asking myself questions. What could this possibly mean? Why would Jennifer Kesey, who had recently purchased and moved into her own condominium, be inquiring about an apartment down the road? And if she was distracted and wasn't actually interested in the apartment, who is she hiding from? But I wouldn't even have time to consider these questions, or their possible answers, because Erica's story wasn't over.
Going from there, there was a strange situation where outside of my apartment, and it was like Monday evening, it was like late at night, and there was my husband and I, we had fallen asleep on our couch, and at that time, I lived in Northbridge, and I had this really cool apartment, which was over the top of the entryway, over the overpass, and the cars would actually drive underneath into the gate underneath my apartment. They would actually drive underneath my apartment. And my apartment was very long, and it had large windows, and it was next to the office. And my apartment would face the outside of the entrance of the community going towards Millennium Boulevard. And then when I turned around, I could see the opposite direction. The other windows on the other side of my apartment face the inside of the community. I can see the entire community from the other side. It was late, like Monday evening. What I recall was that I we had fallen asleep on the couch, and it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and I heard a female scream, like, saying, "Help, somebody, please help me." And I remember just some talking outside, like, almost like an agitated conversation going on between some people. Well, when I heard this female say, "Somebody, please help me," I immediately just, like, jumped up, and I ran over to my blinds, and I peered through the blinds, and I saw this vehicle sitting, like, right next to the roundabout. And it was facing out. It was facing in the direction as if it was leaving the community. And so there was this guy who takes this blonde-headed girl out of the front seat of this car, opens the back door. The girl is standing there in front of the back passenger door, and she has her hand up almost like, you know, like, not like she's being arrested, but she's like almost like she's like, her left hand is up, and she's almost just like having conversations, like, almost like she's saying to the person, "I don't understand," or "please stop," or something like that. Her hand was up with an expression as if she just didn't, you know, like, understand the situation. So this guy is talking to her, and he's talking to her in a way that it's almost like someone who's in a relationship with someone who is sort of kind of they're in a fight or borderline abusive relationship. But the guy grabs the girl by the neck, and he starts, like, talking to her, like, really close to her face. And she's kind of cowering down just a little bit, you know, because obviously he's, like, pushing her neck down, like, I guess trying to maybe, like, assert his dominance over her. It just looked like she knew him, it could have been an acquaintance or a friend that she pissed off, and that she was just like, "I'm sorry, like, you know, I don't understand, like, okay. This is, you know," and just basically what I could see was there was somebody else in the car, but somebody else was sitting in the back seat on the opposite side. And all I could see was somebody's, like, legs from their knees down. And it was obviously a male, because it wasn't a female. I could tell that this person had, you know, men's shoes on, and obviously the person had black pants on and black shoes. He puts her in the car, and they peel out and take off. And at this point, like, I told my husband, "I'm going to call the police," because, you know, it's late at night, and this girl's screaming for help, and this guy's grabbing this girl by her neck. And I call the police. The police officer comes out, and he takes a statement, and we tell him, you know, what had happened. We walked outside and said, this is what just happened. I just grabbed the car. It was a black car, four-door, and they peeled off, and that was it.
Erica had also shared this story when she called the crime line after she realized that Jennifer was the person she had seen in the Northbridge office just before her disappearance.
And I also let them know that on Monday night, there was a female that was outside of our community at the roundabout at about 11 o'clock at night, and there was an altercation between some person and, you know, a guy. And this girl, and the girl had the same length hair, the same color hair, the same body build. The look was literally exactly like Jennifer. And I remember this girl was wearing, like, she looked like she was getting ready for bed or something. But she had sweatpants on and a tank top. I thought that was very odd, and I was thinking that the crime line FBI, because they're FBI, would put two and two together and would actually, you know, investigate more. Nobody ever asked, nobody ever called, nobody ever inquired about it or contacted me just to even ask anything further about it, which I thought was absolutely insane, considering that it was just, you know, it was an abduction case, or, you know, this is like a big deal. This person just went missing, and all of, you know, it's all that's being, you know, spoken about on the news, and basically all of Orlando is in an uproar because this, you know, young, beautiful girl has gone missing. So, and that was, you know, that was pretty much, you know, what had happened. And I didn't realize until several months later, because there were the investigation, it was continuing on, and there were all these, you know, at that time too, like the crazies were coming out, and you had thousands of people call on the FBI crime line and were saying that they had seen her here, or just all sorts of stuff. And when I remember when I was speaking to the person, it was a woman, and I remember speaking to her when I called the crime line, and she was just as bored and as nonchalant as you could possibly be. And I felt like, lady, are you listening to me? Are you listening to what I'm telling you? This girl came into my office, and something was wrong. And then this situation happens outside of my apartment. Don't you think that maybe she might have known somebody that lived there? And it was just like their questions that they asked me were just very vague. Their reaction towards asking me the questions and responding was just vague and uninterested. It was almost like, you know, like they were taking an order of French fries at McDonald's and they just could care less. Which really, honestly, just really pissed me off.
Erica also described the man that she saw outside of the car pushing the girl into the back seat.
This guy was he was as tall as her, just maybe like almost eye to eye, but maybe just about an inch or two taller than she was. And he had dark hair, either black or very dark brown, and he had light skin. He looked like he could have been Hispanic. Not like a Hispanic, like a, you know, a tan Puerto Rican or, you know, Dominican, or he looked like he could have been a Cuban, or he looked like he could have been, because Cubans have like, can have very light colored skin. Well, of course, any Hispanic can, but he looked Hispanic, but he had very light, fair skin.
What did his hairstyle look like? Did you see that at all?
His hairstyle, Sean, looked like the very same image that I showed you. Very same. And I'm not trying to say that this is that person, because, you know, I don't know who that person is, and I don't want to say that. But I'm telling you, when I saw that, I fixated on that, and I was like, oh, my God, like, who is this person, and why is it that his face looks like that person that was out there that night grabbing her neck?
Erica's story is a lot to take in. It's hard to make sense of. We have Jennifer Kessie acting strangely in an apartment complex a mile from her home, just days before she disappears. And then, possibly again, the night before she was reported missing, Monday, January 23rd. This has the potential to completely change everything. For starters, if this statement is true, it takes us back to a nighttime abduction. It places Jennifer Kessie away from her condo after her phone conversation with her boyfriend, which is her last known contact with anyone. It also places Jennifer at a very specific location, on two separate dates, under strange circumstances, This whole thing opens up more questions than it possibly answers. For example, just days after she is apparently hiding from someone in an apartment office, she goes on vacation with her boyfriend, and everything seems fine. None of it makes sense. To me right now, the biggest question is, did Jennifer Kesey know someone who lived at Northbridge? And that's where our investigation continues. But if we put all of that aside for a moment, I can't for the life of me understand why this tip, left on the crime line the day after Jennifer was reported missing, was never followed up on. If this tip is true, it's incredibly significant. And at the very least, it's worth talking to the witness. Even if this witness is lying, there's just no excuse that it's not being followed up on. And while we're on that topic, last episode you heard from Lisa, the witness that believes she saw Jennifer Kesey at a jewelry store in Tennessee. And we now know, after making her story public, that detectives are finally looking into it. So if anything else, we can say that getting Lisa's account of the event under the microscope of professionals is a good thing, regardless of the outcome. Now, the reason I bring this up is because I came to learn in the aftermath of episode 4 that the crime line, the same tip line that's on Jennifer's missing posters, the same tip line that Lisa called and left her story 3 times, and the same tip line that Erica called and left her story, none of those things were ever followed up on. So what's the point of the crime line then? It appears to be failing Jennifer Kesey left and right. The explanation I was given is that information left on the crime line is required to remain anonymous, and contact information will not be given to authorities, even if the tipster is requesting them to do so. Therefore, in my opinion, unless you want to be anonymous, if you know something about the case, anything at all, call the Orlando police directly and make sure you talk to the detectives who are working this case. And keep calling until you do. Because at first, Lisa, that Tennessee witness, she did call the Orlando police directly. And she did ask to speak to the detectives. But she was directed back to the tip line, back to the crime line, which we now know went nowhere for 7 months. So again, if you're out there and you know something and you want to share it with investigators, it's time to call again, even if you've called the crime line before. Call Orlando Police and don't give up until you speak directly to those who are responsible for this investigation. For now, our investigation continues. We will further consider the events at Northbridge on our sidebar Sunday. But about that picture that Erica says looks like the person she saw, we'll get into that next time on Unconcluded. Before we go, remember that if this show is going to find answers, you have to be part of it. And thank you to those of you who already are. Thank you to those of you who have been participating and spreading the word and sharing with your friends. Thank you to those of you who have joined the conversations on our Facebook group, called or written in questions and comments for our sidebar episodes, and an extra huge thank you to those of you who have supported us on Patreon. Don't forget that if you enjoy the show, one of the best ways that you can help is with a positive rating and review on iTunes. We will be back in just a week with our next sidebar episode. We'll see you then. Unconcluded is produced by Scott J and myself. Music in this episode by Lee Rosvear and PC3.